Isaiah 29:13 tells us that we should approach God with our hearts, not just with our lips. I'm Dr. Fred, and you're listening to Study, Grow, Know.
Welcome to Study, Grow, Know, where we discuss theology, prophecy, and current political issues from a conservative biblical perspective. Here's your host, Dr. Fred DeRuvo.
Hi, thanks for joining me. This is Dr. Fred. You're listening to another episode of Study, Grow, Know. You know, Isaiah 29:13 tells us that often, more often than not, the people approached God with their lips, but not with their hearts. And God basically tells them through the prophet, you know, I know what you're doing. You're honoring me with your lips. In other words, you're giving me lip service. But hearts were far from them. Jesus pretty much says the same thing in Matthew 15:8, where he quotes the previous passage from Isaiah. And the truth of the matter was that though the people did what they were supposed to do, as God says in Isaiah and to Isaiah, the hearts of the people were not in it at all. They had reduced worship of God to a type of work that they were able to do without even thinking about it. Now, because of this and their attitudes, the people of Israel toward God, they wound up dishonoring him routinely. This was one of the biggest reasons that God at times sent another nation to overcome Israel and bring them into captivity. They would wind up simply honoring him with their lips, and then they would start straying and worshiping other gods. Now, of course, God eventually knew that these people who had been ignoring him would begin to call out to him once again, and that was the purpose for it. God chose chastisement as a means of regaining the honor that he deserved from the people and nation he had created. And because of the new generations, though, it wasn't long before that new generation would begin to emotionally move away from God and dabble in idolatry until it often overwhelmed them and completely pushed God out of the picture. Even so, the people continued the practice of worshiping God with their lips, even when their hearts were far from him. Now, in many ways, this is how both of the sons in the parable of the prodigal son reacted toward their father. They did what was expected of them because that's what good sons did. They didn't like it, and it mostly showed in their attitudes, I'm sure, toward their father. Yet the father continued to love both of his sons. When the young son came and demanded his inheritance, it was another way of the young son saying to the father, you know what, I wish you were dead, and I'm treating you as if you're dead by asking for my inheritance now while you're still alive. I can't imagine as a parent what that would feel like, but I'm certain it wouldn't feel good at all. Now, the father gave his son what he demanded, but did not deserve. He gave his inheritance to him, likely knowing full well that that young son would leave to sow wild oats and ignore his upbringing. The father opted to do two things he probably didn't want to do. First, he gave his son what the son demanded, and second, he allowed his son to leave. This is God's graciousness toward us. He sometimes gives us what he knows best for us because it can teach us the truth about ourselves and God. He allows us to go where he might not want us to go because of the potential outcome. It's not unusual for me to receive nasty or sarcastic notes from atheists because of the things I write at my blog at www.studygrownoblog.com. Often it seems as though these individuals go out of their way to castigate me for my beliefs and my opinions when they could simply ignore it. When they do submit a response to one of my blogs, if they have a point, I'll often post it, even if they are being extremely arrogant and petty. Well, my wish for them is that they'll come to see the truth. God's desire for them is that they will forsake their atheism and come to him for salvation. What always amazes me about atheists is that they're so sure that God does not exist. They're positive, in fact. Yet when you ask them to prove it to you, they will tell you without hesitation that you can't prove a negative. When they respond like this, they simply do not realize that they're contradicting themselves. Obviously, they have come to a point of quote-unquote knowing, which is really simply believing, that God does not exist. Somehow, they've proved it to themselves that this is the case. If they have proved it to themselves, then they should be able to prove it to me, but they can't. And they know they can't, so they rely on the you can't prove a negative ploy. All I'm asking is that they present to me the same information that caused them to believe what they believe about God, that he doesn't exist. It's truly pitiful that these individuals are not aware of the problems in their own belief system, yet they arrogantly attack my position. This is what people do to God all the time. Much of the non-Christian world believes that God does not exist. They haven't seen him, therefore there's no real proof given of his existence. Because of this, they believe that somehow proves that God doesn't exist. You know, it's funny, the arrogance of human beings can be staggering sometimes. Imagine how much God sees and hears on a daily basis, yet he continues to ignore it for the time being in the hopes that these same people will come to the realization that their viewpoints about God are decidedly wrong. He wants them to see him through the eyes of faith so that they might, you know, be rewarded with salvation. Is that too much to ask? I don't think so. Now, I've also noticed a trend in which many atheists are actually rising up to defend many other religions and cults, telling me that Christianity is far worse than some of these other groups because of all the evils that have been perpetrated in the name of God. Now, while I would agree that there have been many atrocities done in God's name, this by no means the fault of God or that of authentic Christians, that it lies with them. People like this don't want to hear about the wheat and the tares, for example, in which Jesus explains that Satan came along and sowed tares as soon as the church was born. And you can read about that in Matthew 13, verses 24 through 30 and 36 through 43. Those tares will never be wheat, yet they often appear to resemble wheat, especially in the early stages. It's obvious that the world sees the tares as authentic wheat when it is clearly not the case. In spite of all the teaching that Jesus provided on how badly his church would be attacked, people seem not to care what he said because they are too intent on pulling down authentic Christians. They're so desperate to prove their case that they ignore even the most obvious signs of being wrong. Yet in all of this, God's patience prevails for now. There will come a time when he will arrive at the end of his patience and put his judgments into actions. And fortunately, for the lost of the world, that time is not quite now, and people still have the opportunity to turn to him. And this is exactly the way the father in the parable treated his sons. He hoped that one day they would come to the realization that he was not the type of father they had come to believe he was, and he did what he could to engender that attitude within his sons. Up until the time the younger son returned, though, nothing seemed to work, yet the father continued to love his sons. Luke 15:20 says this, "But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him and ran and embraced him and kissed him." Who among us would do what that father did? While you might believe that you would do this, please think again, because it is likely that you don't really understand the import of this parable. Human beings do not naturally set aside wrongs committed against them. It certainly should be done and can be done, but only with God's help. This father's reputation had been trashed by his son. The son treated the father as if he was nothing and demanded that he had no right to demand whatever he demanded. Yet his father gave the son what he wanted, hoping against hope that the young son would come to realize that he had not withheld anything, and even though societal norms would have been on the father's side had he chosen to reject his son's demands, the father did what he could to gain his son's affection. Now, after the son lived his life of sin for a season, he returned to his waiting father. And I've already pointed this out previously, but it's clear that the father was looking for his son, probably glancing many times throughout each day to the horizon in the direction that his son had left. He hoped that one day he would see the silhouette of his son returning. Then one day, it happened. Here was a figure, and from a distance it looked like it could be his son. Yes! It was his son, and the father wasted no time looking like a fool by hiking up the folds of his robe and running toward his son. When he reached his son, he knew from what his son said that the son had returned home with a new attitude. I'm not sure what this would have, you know, I'm not sure if it had made a difference to the father. He was simply glad above all things that his son returned. It took the young son a great deal of money, lots of loose living, and falling to very low depths before he realized that he had it far better at home. The truth hit him, and it hit him hard, and he acted on that truth. Instead of ignoring or rejecting it, he embraced it, and he did what was necessary to follow through on that truth. Because of it, he now saw his father in a completely different light. Now again, this represents just how far God went to gain our attention and fellowship. He sent his son to die so that we might have access to him. In the parable, the father's love was constant and unwavering. He never faltered in his love for either of his sons. They faltered because they did not understand their father as he was, and ascribed to him instead a personality that did not belong to him. In that way, they not only misunderstood their father, but based their terrible decisions on their complete misunderstanding of him. This is no different from what Adam and Eve or you and I do. We at times will come to see God as something he is not, and because of that errant view, we'll make terrible decisions. What is worse, we wind up often bringing great harm to ourselves because of that erroneous view of God. Jesus spent time trying to help the people see that God was not like the Father, the God of the Pharisees described or taught about. Their lives did not reflect God's attitude. They were far off. Jesus wanted them to know in no uncertain terms that God loved them immensely and had done so many things to prove his love. This is how God is toward us as well. To us, he is an infinite amount of patience that stems from his immeasurable love. We need to spend time in his word and in communion with him in order to come to know just exactly who God is and how he views us. God loves us and wants the best for us. That best starts with his salvation, and it grows from there. Please notice that not once did the father in the parable ever try to make his sons feel guilty. It just didn't happen. He never used guilt cues or harsh language with them. The father in the parable was always gentle and fully loving. In fact, he was far more loving than his sons deserved. The same can be said with the way God responds and acts towards us. When the son returned, he knew he had sinned. He knew he had brought dishonor to his father's household. The son knew that he had actually disgraced his father before the neighbors and friends. Yet when the son arrived home, not once did the father try to make his son feel as though he would have to earn his, the father's, respect. Not once is there even a hint of displeasure from the father to the son. The son expected that his father might allow him to become a servant in his father's household. He certainly had not expected that his sins against his father in heaven would be forgiven so completely. He never expected to be embraced and kissed by his father, whom he had so terribly dishonored. The father never made his son kneel before him and grovel. He didn't give him the cold shoulder or ignore him altogether. The father did not treat his son as if he was a worm and would have nothing to do with him until the son realized just how bad he was and how evil were his actions. No, the father did none of these. Instead, the father pushed aside the sins of his son, forgetting them, never even mentioning them. The father embraced his son as his son, not a servant. The father treated his son as royalty, though the son would be the first to say that he did not deserve to be treated in such a way. The father represents God. This is what Jesus is telling us. God will no sooner beat his children over the head with their sin than the father in the parable beat his own son over the head with his sin. The father in the parable knew that his son had returned and that he had done so by walking away from that sinful lifestyle. The father realized that for the son to have made this decision, he had come to understand exactly what he had done. The son exhibited a far greater sense of maturity and understanding than did his own brother. By sinning and literally going off on his own and returning with a new and different attitude, the young son had learned just how much his father loved him. In fact, he likely began to realize that his father had always loved him like this, but he, the son, was too blind to see it because his eyes had always been on himself. And you know what, folks? That's us. We do that too often. And God is always waiting for us, to turn around and turn away from our sinful lifestyle. And that's what the younger son did. And unfortunately, the older son did not do that. Well, before we go, I just want to remind you that if you go to my website, www.studygrowknow.com, you can click on any book and get it for free as a PDF. Until next time, may God open your eyes to show you how blessed you truly are. Thanks for joining me today.
You've been listening to Study, Grow, Know with Dr. Fred DeRuvo. Please join us each week for new broadcasts that deal with theology, prophecy, and political issues from a biblical, conservative perspective.